for this final session, one of the things that we found from past conferences is that there's so many good ideas that come up, but because of the presentations, we don't have very much chance for discussion. And so we wanted to leave some time in the program, which was a chance really just for some questions, for comments, for discussion. We have up here if you would like to ask us questions or to comment on things, but equally you may want to just comment or discuss within the group. Stephen and Gonya have joined me again, but also Martin Weller from the Open University, who's also worked on all this, has said he was happy to come up and field any questions. So we might do this for perhaps about 20 minutes. We'll see how we go, and then I will give a presentation to finish, and we'll do everything I can to be done before 6 o'clock so we can then complete our long day. So, if I may, I'll open it up. Any questions, comments from the floor or from our speakers to start us off?
That would be no. You're up.
Press it. Oh gosh, that's too late. Yeah, I mean, we were commenting afterwards. Stephen and I didn't check beforehand about the two keynotes, but we thought they were very complementary. And I think a lot of what we're trying to do, the aspirations of the work we're doing, is trying to realise some of that vision. And we're not alone. I mean, if you know, listening to work that Barry and others are doing in Wollongong, and a lot of the other work that's going on in the UK through the JISC programme and elsewhere, and the work that's going on in Spain at the University of Valladolid and Barcelona, etc. There's a kind of synergy here, it seems to me. We're kind of converging towards a similar set of ideas and approaches, the recognition of the importance of better understanding the design process, the move towards much more open and participatory and socially focused approaches to design, the recognition of design as a much more dynamic activity than something that's static. So I think there is generally synergies. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we have got a fairly good collective shared vision now. I think we've got the battle scars of what didn't work, and I think there's the stirrings of evidence that we're moving towards things. I don't know, Stephen, do you think the same?
Yes. Well, I mean, I obviously think that way because that's the vision that I'm sketching out. But, you know, my evidence comes as much from outside the educational domain as inside the educational domain. I look at the evolution of computer programming, and this is something we were talking about yesterday, James, and the evolution of computer programming is paralleled at a later date by the evolution of learning design. And I see the sorts of things that are happening in learning design now that happened in computer programming a number of years ago. And so I see learning design changing from single author branch series of instructions type programs to the multi-author object-oriented environment-based kind of programs. In other words, paralleling what happened in computer programming itself. And I also see the example, which I tried to sketch a bit this morning, of the transition from what some people are now calling Web 1.0 to Web 2.0, the transition from sites that you went to and visited, and you would browse and you'd go through a tour of a website or something like that, to environments where everybody co-creates and communicates and does whatever they feel like doing. Things like, you know, and I, even there, we're only a small part of the way toward that sort of world. I look at things like Flickr and Facebook, and I see only the very first iteration of this more open and more participatory environment that we're going to see more widely. And again, learning design is following this. Online learning is following this, but and it's one of these things. Online learning is a number of years behind, and always has been. But that also leads me to have a fair degree of confidence in the predictions. The very fact that it follows means that I have a pretty good idea where it's going to go, and that's the direction I think it's going to go.
I think changes to learning design will happen, but we may not be the best people to do it. Stephen and I, separately, we're both part of the learning objects field, and learning objects were the big hope. And education were the wrong people to do it. We kind of came at it and stuck loads of metadata on it and made it kind of god-awful. Yeah. But then people like SlideShare come along, and SlideShare is a fantastic learning object repository in a way, but we just don't think of it that way. And we need to make a similar transition for learning design. So I bet when it does become successful, we probably won't call it learning design. It will be called BuzzWow or something like that. And there'll be some kind of company that runs it. But it'll actually be something that works. You know, it's like, and you can begin to see that in the way that people take things like Yahoo Pipes and pull content together very simply in that kind of way. And it's almost like you want a Yahoo Pipes for learning, I think. So I sometimes worry that us academics, when we come to it, we kind of just put death all over it. We've got to keep trying. Yeah.
One of the ideas that's hit me with more force in the last 24 hours than before would be providing more support within the learning design systems for the collaborative authoring. At the moment, there are certain things you can do. I can create a set of activities, and then I can put it in an area that Stephen could get to, and he could edit it a bit, and then I could go and get it and look at it and change it again. But it's a pretty cumbersome process. And so, to put it as simply as I know how, if we could take the Google Docs idea, that is, there's just one document on the internet that various people could edit, if you could do that to the LAMS authoring environment so that a whole bunch of people could be editing, suggesting, changing, and so on, that seems to me to be a modest but useful step forward for those contexts where the kind of collaborative authoring would be useful. And that might be teams of educators or, as Stephen said, could be teams of students working together and deciding on what they'd like to do. So in a very sort of practical, concrete way, that seems something that we could have a go at, subject to how hard it is to do technically. And remember, I don't write any of the code, so I can promise all I like. And poor Ernie and the team have to deliver. But that seems to be certainly one quite specific thing that might be useful going forward. I think I'm to some extent still an unreconstructed teacher, and so I would say that there is a significant role for the teacher who understands the discipline to a level where they can recommend to students the ways activities might be done, or given the knowledge of the way that learning happens in this field, here is a good set of activities that would help a group of students to learn. And so I would not, to me there's still a strong and important role for the teacher who knows better, in inverted commas, or at least who knows something to recommend about learning within this context. But I wouldn't want to suggest that, that is contrary to all the other ideas we had before. I think they can all live together, and what we want to move to is a context where the power structures between teachers and learners change so that teachers can recommend good ideas, learners can take them and say, well, I would like to try this but not try that, and sort of together there can be more agreement on what is done. I must also say, personally, I'm not too worried about informal learning and personal learning as an area. I think the tools are interesting and great, and people, students, people like us, we will go and do those things in our own lives anyway. It's actually formal learning that worries me a lot more. The learning done in schools and universities within the constraints, that's the bit that seems to me to be particularly resistant to change. And so at least one of my main drivers in the work we do on LAMS is to try and think what would be a useful step forward within that constrained and formal context. And I at least hope that some of the ways that LAMS and, for that matter, other learning designs encourage a more activity-driven view of learning rather than a content-only driven view of learning. If we can move to more student co-creation and development, that also would be, these would be steps in a direction that might help formal learning to open up. And although it may still be many years behind what's happening in the wider internet world and in the, you know, informal learning that we all do all the time, I at least hope it would be a positive step in those kind of directions.
What I think would be interesting, and what I think, after we have this first iteration where we have a shared design space where people can design collaboratively, what that means right now is, you know, dragging and dropping things. I think where things really become interesting in the concept of design is when there is some sense of shared creation of the tools. We had a longish talk about that too. It was sort of the beginning part of our talk, and about what's involved in creating a tool, and how do you make a tool interact with LAMS and send information back and forth. Because I'd like to see tools that aren't really obviously tools. You know, the tools that are available now are discussion boards and chats and that sort of things. And I'd really like to see in LAMS, an actual academic environment like LAMS, a tool like a racing car that you go in and you configure, and then your racing car interacts with other racing cars or whatever. Or whatever sort of thing that the students can think of that could be dragged and dropped into this environment and interact with the people and with the other things in that environment. I think when design is opened up in that way, where the constraints, a lot of these constraints that inform our educational thinking are removed, I think we'll get some very interesting kinds of learning design, where learning design goes so much beyond what we currently think of it, what we think of as being possible. You know, sort of like, and it's a phenomenon I see over and over again. I'm sure you're all familiar with Second Life. And Second Life is, you know, a 3D environment. People can enter Second Life and create whatever sort of object that they want to create. And people have created some very interesting things, although my experience of Second Life is that it's 99% casinos, but that's just my experience. But what's interesting and sadly typical is that educators enter Second Life and the first thing they do is they build a school with a table and chairs in a row just like this. And, you know, it's that first iteration. The virtual always seems to need to resemble the actual. But in Second Life now, they're beginning to think a bit beyond that. There's one thing in Second Life where it's a very large model of a molecule, and you can actually walk around in and through the molecule and things like that, the sorts of things that you could not possibly do in a school. We can't put a 10-foot high molecule in this room, is because molecules are only that big. So, and I think that's the same sort of thing with learning design. Learning design now is what has happened in the classroom, and indeed even the discussions today that I've seen about, you know, thinking about what design is and how to approach design, the mechanism that has been used is to go ask instructors, how do you design your instruction? And so of course the learning design that results is going to be something that resembles what instructors actually do in the class. But there are so many more affordances of a tool like LAMS or anything similar to that. If you remove the constraint that learning design needs to be whatever it is that instructors do in the classroom, then you get the learning design equivalent of 10-foot high molecules. You get a view of learning that is something unique. What that view is, I don't know. But it's the sort of thing that will be discovered by, you know, a widespread participatory creation of different types of tools and different types of designs involving those tools.
I really agree with you with that, and I think it's really interesting. My background's actually chemistry, and you know, when I very first got into the web, there was some really innovative early uses of the web with things like RASMOL, where you could interact with molecules and stuff, which were really exciting. And I think it is about moving beyond. And I think if we only ever focus on what an instructor's currently doing, it's very limited, it's pointless. Interestingly enough, we must be mad, but 2 weeks today, I am running an event in the UK with a whole bunch of school kids where we're letting them go crazy on absolutely this. So we're taking in huge craft design box, Josie's design boxes, and we're just going to let the kids go crazy thinking about design in a completely different way. And we've also got a group of adults, both teachers and different stakeholders from local leisure parks and eco parks and systems, and so they're all going to attack the design from different ways. Now, it might be a complete nutter disaster, and I'll probably go home with lollipop sticks in my hair, but it could be interesting to see about what happens if you really kind of free up the design process in that way.
And you'll document this and put it on the internet? So that
if I survive.
I think going back to your point, Stephen, about how things resemble the first order stuff, first of all, I think you can think of it as like a succession model, when I think often we kind of want revolution, but actually it's usually kind of very gradual change. Just think of like when you get a kind of barren landscape, the first things that move in there are kind of a few grasses and mosses. They kind of colonise the area, and then they die, and they break down, and they make the soil slightly better for other things to move in afterwards. And so you get this kind of colonisation process going on. And you can think of that with technology, and like however much we don't like things like Blackboard and that, you can think of them as kind of primary colonisers, because they weren't very threatening for academics. They kind of represented a classroom model. But then you begin to get people thinking, actually, I want to do a bit more than this, you know. And so then they want to start looking at tools like LAMS, and then perhaps they want to start looking at, you know, pulling together their own applications around it. So although we do kind of get impatient, I think sometimes you have to recognise there is a kind of a gradual process that's happening there. And you can see that a lot of the time, I think.
I think just the only bit I'd add to that would be one of the key drivers, certainly for me and others around LAMS, has been a tool that would be simple to use for many teachers, not only the experts. And so I think one of the tricks for the future as we move in this way is trying to get the right layering, which says if you can imagine building a really new environment with new tools that you can build, here are all the components and interfaces, go do that, that would be awesome. But then once you've done it, can you share it into the wider infrastructure in a way that would then be actually quite simple for a teacher who could never have built that tool, but when given it, could easily configure it a little bit or switch it to do something interesting with? You know, we're not asking everyone to be able to imagine how to create chess as a new game. You know, to think up chess from scratch is a very challenging task. But once it's been created, the fact that you could use it and maybe imagine slight variations on it, that for me would be a really important thing to do. So we're, as a community, we need to be able to think about the things that experts can create for us because of their specialist expertise, but equally, how do we then make that easily disseminated and easily usable by people so they get the benefits, even if they themselves might not have been able to create that thing. So that for me would be a key next step of getting the success out of this, is somehow having a technical infrastructure and tools and interfaces that allowed for all sorts of amazing things, but didn't, as a byproduct, then make it so difficult to use that 95% of teachers would go, too hard. So trying to get that balance right would be a key driver, certainly for me personally.
Of course, if the students are the ones using it, it can be harder to use.
Yes.
Resist.
That's true.
Can I just make a comment on what you're saying? I think you can talk about tools development. It's really just a comment on what's been said about tools development, but I think we have to remember the importance of people in the design process as well. And as much as we need to develop tools, we really need to be making sure that we're developing people at the same time, and probably actually we need to put more investment into that kind of development and make sure that it happens, so we get confident communities of users that can do just exactly what you were saying there, James, as well. So I think that's very key.
James mentioned informal learning, and I think, coming back on your point, I think informal learning may actually be the driver that makes change in higher education. And you see the same with tools. It's going to be because people are having a great time in Facebook and then they come into this, God, uninspiring environment we give them in higher education. Why can't I do this fun stuff here? You know, it's like, and I think in the same way with informal learning, if people are like, hey, I've created a course about, you know, understanding Harry Potter novels that 500,000 people have taken around the world, but why can't I get that kind of stuff in higher education? So I think you'll get a driver from those kind of communities in that way. I think you're right, but I wonder whether it's from the outside in to higher education.
Conscious of time, is there perhaps any one last burning question or comment that people have? Okay, well then, let me just go to the panel briefly. Can I ask Isu, I mean, what one thing strikes you most from today? Just, I'm interested of what you've heard or ideas or discussions over lunch. What, you know, what is it that sticks with you from what's happened today?
Two halves. I think one is that I feel we've each got bits of the jigsaw puzzle and that perhaps we should be able to put that together. And the second one is about the social dimensions. That's clear, the open and social dimensions is clearly where we need to go. Collaboration, social openness has come up throughout the day in various ways.
I think for me it's still this kind of tension between all the stuff we want to do and all the fun stuff and the higher education structures that we often come up against, you know, and I think perhaps assessment is a really good example of that. You know, you could, in the session I was in this morning, we were talking about how, you know, teachers found sometimes using LAMS kind of threatening in a way because it was giving control to the children to run their own stuff, and that's kind of not what they've been taught. But that's partly because in the UK and in other places, like, the government says this is what you should be teaching, this is how you should be teaching it, and the idea is you're in control all the time. And I think that letting go of control is a hard thing to do sometimes, and often we're getting kind of contrary messages from what the community wants and then what kind of government initiatives and things that are kind of demanding.
Well, oops, sorry audio people. I mean, both of those things, right? The idea of community participation in creating learning resources, I think, is key. And issues of control, I think, are also key. And of course, they are two sides of the same coin. And I will say this too, because, and this is always going to be the case in a discussion of learning design, properly so-called and capitalized, this idea that, you know, the tools need to be accessible to educators, they need to be non-threatening to educators, etc. So long as that is the condition, there is going to be a certain limit beyond which these tools cannot go, because educators have a certain body of interest, right? It's the tools will that undermine their position will in the end never be accepted by educators. They will develop outside the formal education system. And I think that the long-term future of online learning is outside the formal education system. And I think that change, when it comes to the educational system, will not be evolutionary, will not be the result of tools that were developed in order to be comfortable and non-threatening to educators, but will be the result of quite the opposite. It will be the result of something very disruptive, like, say, the internet, being practically forced on educators from outside. And I think that, you know, things like learning design will reflect that over time, no matter what the present intent of learning design is. And so I'm seeing that conflict. I expected to see that conflict here, and I did see that conflict here. But, you know, the overriding impression is that that I get from this group anyways is that people are dealing with it and the tool is going to move forward anyways, I think, and I see that movement in that direction.
That was confusing, wasn't it?
I'm conscious that I get to get up at the podium next, so I won't have any more comments at this point. Can you perhaps just join me in thanking our speakers for coming up one more time?
Just one.